This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Christine Wong and you're listening to Raise Your Game on Enterprise. Today I'm speaking to Roman Krznarek, author of Carpe Diem, Seizing the Day in a Distracted World. So first of all, thank you very much for coming on our show.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Great. So let's just, start with the basics. What is the concept behind the book?
So the whole idea of the book is there's this phrase, carpe diem, normally translated as seize the day. And it's one of the oldest philosophies of life in, certainly in the Western world. It goes back to a poem written in 23 BC by the Roman poet Horace. And the last two lines of his poem really sum up what it was all about. He said, "Even as we speak, envious time flies past. Seize the day and leave as little as possible for tomorrow." And of course, he was talking about the big question is, how do we take the opportunities in life, given that life is short and our time is always running out and the clock is ticking? And the interesting thing about this phrase, carpe diem, you put it into Google, you'll get over 25 million search results. It's an incredibly popular idea. It has other forms such as YOLO, you only live once, that Twitter hashtag you see everywhere. So it's a very important kind of motivational ideal. But I've written a book partly about what this idea really means, but also how it's been hijacked by modern culture, by consumerism and digital culture, and we're losing touch with the original ideal that goes back to this Roman poet.
What are some of the ideas that you found about carpe diem?
Yeah, well, there have always been different meanings of seizing the day or carpe diem. If you look through history, probably the most popular is the idea that carpe diem is about seizing opportunities in life. So possibilities or chances that only come along once, whether it might be the chance to change career or open a business or save a relationship that's falling apart. And I guess one of the most obvious things about that is it sounds very easy to seize those opportunities in life or in work, but there are many really fundamental barriers to doing it. I mean, one of the most important, of course, is what psychologists call risk aversion. That's the way that human beings naturally tend to go for security rather than change. We stick with what we know rather than trying something new. And there was a very famous psychology experiment about this done by Dan Kahneman and Amos Tversky. And what they did is they asked people to bet on the toss of a coin. And if the coin landed tails, landed down, you'd lose $100. The question is, how much would you have to be offered when the coin landed heads for you to be willing to take the bet? So if you were going to lose $100 for tails and the win would be $100 for heads, most people wouldn't take that bet. If the loss was $100 and the win was $150 for heads, still most people wouldn't take that bet. But if the loss was $100 and the win was $200, most people would take that bet. And their conclusion was, we hate losing about twice as much as we like winning, or the pain from a loss is about double the pleasure from a gain. And what it means is that if you're in the world of work, for example, you might focus on everything that might go wrong rather than what might go right when you're thinking, for example, of starting up a new business, and that's going to stop you from seizing the day. It's partly about weighing up the risks, but then it's also about getting the bigger perspective on life. You know, I'm a philosopher, and although my books and ideas, whether it's on empathy or carpe diem, are used, for example, in the business world, I do come at these things from quite a philosophical position, but I think so do a lot of, for example, big CEOs. I mean, classically, someone who is interested in carpe diem was Steve Jobs, and he gave a famous talk called How to Live Before You Die, and it was after he'd first recovered from cancer, pancreatic cancer, and he used to say that every morning he would look in the mirror and say to himself, if this were the last day of my life, would I do what I'm about to do today? And that idea actually goes back to ancient Roman thinkers about carpe diem and the idea of living every day as if it were your last. And I think for a lot of people, it's a real motivator because it's that idea of death, really, that makes us think, okay, is this what I should be doing? Am I wasting my life by staying in a job that I don't enjoy or running a business I don't like? But I think it's quite an interesting idea to think about living every day as if it's your last. So, for instance, there's a problem here of moral responsibility. You know, just because it's your last day doesn't mean it's everybody else's as well. You know, maybe we should exercise our freedom, but what impacts might our actions have on other people? Steve Jobs doesn't really talk about that when he talks about seizing the day and living every day as if we were last. And then also, why not flip that whole idea around? Why not live every day as if you're first rather than your last? Almost approach life with a sense of wonder or curiosity. And I think that's also a really important ideal in life.
Right. So kind of either way, it's making the most of your finite time on the earth, I suppose, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we live in cultures, certainly in Western culture, and maybe this is in Malaysia too, where the idea of death is kind of pushed away. The advertising industry tells us that we're forever young. We put elderly people away in care homes out of sight and out of mind a lot of the time. We don't like talking very explicitly about death. And actually, this stops us really connecting with that carpe diem or seize the day ideal. It stops us really living with a passion or engaging in what I think of as radical aliveness. And I think these things are really important when, for example, if you're thinking about career change, okay, I think we need to seize the day if we're going to do it well. If you're on the search for finding fulfilling work, for example, and I've written another book about this called How to Find Fulfilling Work, but I also talk about it in my new Carpe Diem book. You know, for the last 200 years, we've basically been told, if you want to find a job, what you do is you do what I think of as think first and act afterwards. In other words, you do lots of thinking and planning. You draw up lists of your strengths and weaknesses. You maybe do some personality tests, and you work out what job might be right for you. Then you start sending off applications. Now, that might get you a job, but it's unlikely to be a fulfilling one. Why? Because you haven't tried out that job in reality. You haven't done shadowing or internships or volunteering. And carpe diem tells you to do the opposite. It's about experiential living. Instead of thinking and acting, you act first and think afterwards. And there's lots of research in career change, for example, showing that this is the best way for you to find the job that really works for you, by testing your different identities out or selves out in the real world. And it's certainly something I've done myself. You know, I used to have a job working as a community worker, which I wasn't particularly enjoying, and I wanted to start teaching my own classes on the art of living. And after complaining about this to my wife for 3 months, saying how I wanted to do this, but I didn't know how, I wasn't sure I'd be successful, I couldn't even think of where to hold my classes on the art of living, she said to me, why don't you just hold the first one next Saturday in our kitchen? And that was like a bolt of carpe diem lightning. I suddenly thought, oh my God, I must do this. And that Saturday, I held my first classes on the art of living. I invited friends and friends of friends, and that eventually grew to me doing more kitchen classes on the art of living, workshops, and then doing them in public spaces. Then I ended up helping to found a global organization called the School of Life, which now has branches in 14 countries, which is all about teaching classes on the art of living. And that was a classic, by me, an experiment of acting first and thinking afterwards, or seizing the day rather than doing lots of planning before taking action.
Yeah, I think especially when it comes to the differences between Western and Asian culture, Asian people tend to be a lot more cautious and a lot more risk averse, as you've kind of mentioned before. So the idea is that we usually think a lot, but we never do. Whereas I think this philosophy is more do and then think later, right?
Yeah, I think so. And certainly, I mean, I don't have that much experience of Asian culture, though. I lived in Hong Kong for 5 years. And there is that idea of security being so important. Of course, it's also important in, you know, Western culture as well. In a time of job insecurity, for example, nobody's jobs are secure anymore. But I think if you want to make change in your life, it requires risk. And we have to start feeling okay about the idea of learning through failure. That, of course, every business that you start or every job that you move to may not work out. And then you've got children, and then you've got rent to pay and all these very important things. But in the end, I guess we've only got one life. And the question is, what are we going to do with it? And do we want to get to the end of our life and feel regrets? I mean, I advise people to do a thought experiment. I call it the dinner party of the afterlife. And what I mean by that is, imagine you have died and you are in the afterlife, you're dead, and you're at a dinner party, And at this dinner party are all the other yous who you could have been if you had made different choices. So there's maybe the you who left your boring job as a lawyer and started an internet startup company. There's the you who didn't make enough effort to hold your marriage together and it fell apart. There's the you who almost died in a car accident and changed your life radically afterwards. There's all these different selves, and you can look at them and think to yourself in this thought experiment, which of these many selves would I rather be or become? Are some of them that attract me, some of them that don't? And that kind of thought experiment helps put our life in a bit of perspective, thinking, okay, do you really want to get to your end of your life and live with regret for the things that you hadn't done?
I kind of want to focus on the idea of, you know, the fact that you only have one life. And so therefore, in a way, with that thought experiment, it's about thinking about where you want that life to go when considering all the other options. So I just want to focus on the content of your book, because your first chapter is titled Carpe Diem, From Horus to YOLO. So I just want to kind of go into that and, you know, talk to you a little bit about, you know, that kind of link between how it's taken this concept of Carpe Diem all the way to this hashtag.
Yeah, well, through history, there have been really five different ways that people have thought about seizing the day. And in a way, these are different ways of expressing your personal freedom. So one way we've talked about a bit already is the idea of Carpe Diem, meaning seizing opportunities in life. A second way that people have thought about it historically in the last 500 years or even longer is the idea of Carpe Diem as spontaneity. So getting rid of that electronic calendar and the highly scheduled life and being a bit more experimental with the way that you live. And I think that's important because our culture is really one that destroys spontaneity. You know, the idea, for example, of time management is all about fitting in as much as we can into the schedule, making us busier and busier and more productive, but it doesn't necessarily make us more free. So spontaneity is a second form of carpe diem. A third form of carpe diem is the idea of carpe diem as hedonism, the seeking of pleasures, which is quite an untrendy thing. You know, you rarely pick up a self-help book that says, oh, you should deal with your problems by going out and having a few drinks or, you know, bungee jumping or whatever. But all these things, actually, the seeking of pleasure is important. A fourth form of seizing the day in this journey from Horus to YOLO is Carpe Diem as presence, about seizing the day. For many people today now means living in the present moment, being in the here and now. Now, 100 years ago, people would never have thought that. And the reason why this particular idea of being in the here and now is such a common idea of seizing the day is due to the rise of the mindfulness movement. And I'm sure you've probably had mindfulness experts come and talk on your program in the past. But what I've found in my research is some critiques of the idea of being mindful in that living in the now sense, present moment awareness. And what some of the critics are saying is, look, yeah, it's very okay to be mindful, and that might help you deal with your stress and anxiety in your job. But there are lots, we have to remember, there are lots of different ways of being in the present moment. So psychologists also talk, for example, about what's called flow experience, like the flow of a river. And that is an experience where you are so engaged in what you are doing that neither the past nor the future matters. You're utterly in the moment. As athletes say, you're in the zone. You're so engaged with what you're doing, nothing else seems to matter. And we've all been in those situations of flow, whether you might be giving a talk at work, or you might be cooking a meal for your family, or doing a really difficult sport or rock climbing or something. And the guy who explored flow experience first in the 1970s, a psychologist called Mahai Csikszentmihalyi said, this flow experience is very different from a calm, mindful experience of meditation or something like that. You're often doing something which is really difficult or challenging. You're out of your comfort zone. And we have to remember that this is a very important form of well-being, this flow experience. And we can try and seek flow experiences in our work by challenging ourselves, stepping out of our comfort zone. So those are sort of some of the different ways of thinking about seizing the day. And there's a fifth way, which is about carpe diem in the sense of political carpe diem. That's about when people gather together collectively on the streets to bring about social and political change. And of course, we've seen street protests around the world in recent years where people do this, from the umbrella revolution in Hong Kong to women marching against Trump in the United States. Throughout history, you know, political participation has often had this carpe diem feel, almost like a carnival on the streets.
So carpe diem isn't just one philosophy. It has a lot of different interpretations as well.
Yeah, but ultimately what binds these or holds these different interpretations together is two things. One is it's about freedom. It's about having a sense of agency in your life, the idea that you're the author of your own life. You're writing the script. And the other side is this idea of death, that our time is short, the clock is always ticking. And if you never let yourself think about your mortality, you're probably not going to really appreciate the freedom that you have and the opportunities and chances that you have. So there are these two sides, freedom and death. But as I also write about in my book called Carpe Diem, there's also a moral aspect that we need to think about, which is, you know, how do my actions affect the lives of other people? And when I seize the day, how might it be affecting my family or my work colleagues or people in another country? You know, if I seize the day by taking airplane flights everywhere all the time, then my carbon emissions are affecting the lives of future generations. So you might be seizing the day yourself, but you're reducing the possibilities for seizing the days of future generations. And I think we need to be thinking about that aspect as well. And I think it fits very much in the idea of business ethics, social entrepreneurship, all these ideals which are trying to bring ethics back into the world of economics.
Right, I see. That all sounds really, really, really fascinating. And I think it's important that, you know, again, this isn't a selfish philosophy. This is something where you have to, you know, you have to take your, yeah, like you've said, moral responsibility into account as well. And not only, you know, make the most of what you can do, but also see how that will affect other people as well. We'll be taking a short break, but after this, we'll continue discussing Carpe Diem, Seizing the Day in a Distracted World with its author, Roman Krznarek. Stay tuned to Enterprise BFM 89.9.
Best flipping moments. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Christine Wong and you're listening to Raise Your Game on Enterprise. I'm speaking to Roman Krznarek, author of Carpe Diem, Seizing the Day in a Distracted World. So before the break, you were talking a little bit about the five different ways that you can approach Carpe Diem. But I wanted to kind of ask you about a concept in relation to that. We were talking a little bit about the flip sides of mortality, essentially. So thinking about life and death. But you have a chapter that talks a little bit about reinventing existentialism. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, of course. So I think one of the things that's happened to the idea of carpe diem or seizing the day over the last 20 or 30 years is that it has been hijacked in various ways, or it's been sort of stolen. And I think of this as an existential crime, a crime against human freedom. So how exactly has carpe diem been hijacked? Well, I think the idea of seizing opportunities in life in a way has been hijacked by consumer culture. Just do it has really become just buy it, just to play with that Nike slogan. But I think for a lot of people today, seizing the day is about seizing the credit card. It's about making consumer choices. Do I buy Nike or Adidas, iPhone or Samsung? And I think that is really denigrating or eroding the original Carpe Diem idea, which is about making choices not simply in the consumer world, but in making those big choices in life about career, about love and relationships and communities and things like that. And I think what's happened is that the sort of the marketplace and consumer culture has taken over that idea of seizing opportunities. And that's an existential crime, as it were. I also think that Carpe Diem has been hijacked by our age of digital distraction. I mean, we know we are checking our phones on average 110 times a day. We're spending 8 to 10 hours a day looking at a screen. And both you and I are probably even looking at a screen now as we're having this phone call and doing this interview. And I think it's pretty clear to most of us that if I said to you, right, please seize the day right here and now, it's very unlikely that you would flip open your phone or start flipping through TV channels on your remote control, because we know that screen time and looking at our various eye gadgets is a secondary form of experience. It's quite passive rather than active. It's the opposite of experiential carpe diem living. And then I think there's a third big hijacker of existential freedom, and that is our culture of hyper-scheduling. And we mentioned this a bit before, talking about how we're all obsessed with our electronic calendars, and we've got this, you know, massive overload of emails and tweets and social media notifications to deal with, and those start crowding out our freedom, our capacity to be the authors of our own lives. And so there's a big question there about how do we respond to digital culture? I mean, the most obvious thing to do, of course, is to put yourself on a digital diet of some kind. You know, when I sit down at work, I turn off my internet for the first 4 hours so that I can actually focus on what I'm doing, which in my case is writing books. Or when people come into my house, my wife and I, we invite them to leave their phones in a box in the hallway so that they're not constantly checking their phones in front of our little children or in front of ourselves, and we can have real conversations. And more businesses are doing that, of course. They're saying, you know, leave your phone in the lobby when you walk in and let's actually have a real conversation here. So I think we need to challenge these hijackers, and then we get back in touch with the existential value, or that the value of carpe diem as a way of being free in your own life. But there are a lot of these forces or hijackers that we've really got to fight against today. We don't even notice really how they've stolen our freedom.
I think it's interesting that you bring up the technological aspect of this, because, you know, what started out as a way to kind of be cautious and to double check and to, you know, be doubly sure of things has become, in a way, a method for us to be complacent about, you know, the choices that we make and the kind of time that we spend on what we choose to do as well. So, you know, that's something that I think is really fascinating and, you know, really is a factor that, as you said, not a lot of people think about, you know, when they think about how much screen time that they're having and things like that as well, how much that, you know, cuts into their own kind of personal freedom to do things.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, of course, sort of having our experiences filtered by a screen is very different from the real experience. I mean, I've done a lot of work and research, for example, on the theme of empathy, on the capacity to step into the shoes of other people. I've even founded a museum called the Empathy Museum, which travels around the world and invites people to try and step into other people's shoes. And we've been doing these empathy exhibits. We're about to open in Brazil. We're about to do an exhibit with some work with Microsoft in Seattle in a couple of weeks. And it's these kinds of experiences and relationship building, which is very hard to do online, of course. It's a certain way of expressing freedom. So just for example, the Empathy Museum has an exhibit called A Mile in My Shoes. And what happens is you go along to this exhibit, and it's a gigantic shoebox, and you walk inside this giant shoebox, and someone will fit you with a pair of shoes that belong to a stranger. So they might be the shoes of a guy who's been in prison for 14 years, or an unhappy investment banker, or a sex worker, or a Tamil asylum seeker, or an imam. And you can literally put on their shoes and walk in their shoes while listening to an audio narrative of them talking about their life on an MP3 player, and you really experience who they are. And that kind of experiential learning about others is quite hard to do online, of course, and we're still trying to find ways to really find how to be human in the digital world. Some people have avatars, like Mark Zuckerberg recently went on a visit to Puerto Rico to see hurricane damage with his avatar, but he wasn't there. He was sitting in his office in California. And how much of that was a carpe diem experience? Well, I think it was quite a limited carpe diem experience in many ways. So through virtual reality, of course, we are finding ways to try and live our lives more fully online, to make choices which feel meaningful, to explore the senses, to develop relationships. But again, a lot of that technology is at quite an early stage, and still at the moment we're mostly, as I said, obsessively checking our phones over 100 times a day, and it's a kind of madness, really.
Yeah, I think that, you know, bringing up this idea of walking a mile in people's shoes and really, you know, not just experiencing something from a distance, but truly getting involved in having that alternative experience is so interesting. It's kind of the main conceit of like To Kill a Mockingbird, but brought to life in a practical manner in a way. I just want to talk a little bit about the concept of hedonism as well, because when you say the word hedonism, it tends to be associated with very negative connotations, the ideas of like carelessness and kind of overindulgence in a way. You talk a little bit in Carpe Diem about the hidden virtues of hedonism. So can you discuss that a little bit with us?
Yeah, so hedonism is a tricky topic. Because, of course, a lot of people associate this seeking of pleasures with drug overdoses or alcoholism or extramarital affairs. But in the Carpe Diem tradition, this was in the 17th century in Europe, this is the main meaning that people thought of Carpe Diem was about hedonism. But it wasn't this sort of overindulgence. It was more about exploring the senses in different ways, about touching and tasting and feeling the world, really. And I think that human beings have always enjoyed this and found it as an important part of their lives. I think, you know, if you open a self-help book today, it's all about moderation, about staying calm and dieting and balancing work and life and all these kinds of things, which have their place. But I think human beings have always sought pleasures of different kinds. If I think of my children, I have twins, and when they were very little, they're 9 now, in fact, they're 9 tomorrow. But when they're about 3 or 4, when they saw a patch of grass, what did they do? They started spinning round and round like whirling dervishes because they wanted a hedonistic sensory experience, you know, of having the sky spinning around. And I think we all like a little bit of that in our lives. So I think my main point is that we shouldn't totally get rid of this. And of course, historically, hedonism has been a force for cultural change. I mean, one of the most famous examples of this was in the 1960s in the United States, where as part of drug culture, drug culture was a way of expressing opposition to government. In that case, in opposition to the Vietnam War, these things were very closely linked. It was like hedonism was an anti-authoritarian sort of form of messaging. Now, I think that isn't always the way to bring about political change. You know, that's only just one way. We can also vote at the ballot box or become part of NGOs and work, you know, as part of civil society. But hedonism also, I think, has its place, and we shouldn't forget its importance in the human journey.
That's really fascinating to hear this concept of hedonism be defined in a different way from what I think the modern audience is used to. So as a kind of final takeaway before we end the interview, if we are looking towards embracing the concept of Carpe Diem more in our lives, what sort of ideas do you have to help people who might want to embrace this philosophy more?
I think the ultimate thing is to put these 4 words on your fridge: act first, think later. That Carpe Diem is ultimately an experiential approach to life. And in the original Latin, the origin of the word experience goes back to experiment, or experimentia in Latin. And in that word experimentia is another little word, periculum, which means danger. And I think we just need to remember that life is full of risks. It is full of dangers. But if we act first, think later, that's how we're really going to take the most from life. And there's a famous Austrian psychologist in the 1940s and 50s called Viktor Frankl. And he said this, he said, what is a man? And his answer was, a man is a person who continually decides what he is. In other words, what it means to be human is to make choices in life. I think, therefore I am, I choose, therefore I am, rather than I think, therefore I am. So in a way, my final message is spend a few minutes a day thinking about death, putting your life in perspective so that you ultimately make the choices that matter to you.
All right. That all sounds fantastic. That's about all the time we have. Thank you so much to Roman for talking to us about the concept of Carpe Diem today.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure, Christine. Thank you.
All right. This is Christine Wong. I've been speaking to Roman Krznarek, author of Carpe Diem, Seizing the Day in a Distracted World. This has been Enterprise. Stay tuned.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.